From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a Boston-based doctor woke up this morning to the phone call of a lifetime, informing him that he won a Nobel Prize. Also today, the two New York Times reporters who broke the Harvey Weinstein story and helped launch the Me Too movement.
This whole saga is filled with so many surprises in terms of who helped and who hindered and who was on which side.
And stories of Brookline's Holocaust survivors were locked up and forgotten in a storage closet for decades. Now we can hear them.
My mother asked my brother, did they take down your number? He just threw his piece of bread that he got over the fence and he said, you take it. I won't need it anymore.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The Nobel Prize may be the most prestigious award in the world. And as of this morning, another one of Boston's own can add his name to the list of winners. Dr. William Kalin is a researcher at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and he's the Sidney Farber Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. Kalin is among three researchers who won the prize in physiology or medicine for their work into how cells sense and adapt to oxygen availability. Before he woke up this morning to a 5 a.m. phone call with the incredible news, he went to bed not expecting anything of the sort.
Funny because I tried to ignore that today was Nobel Prize Monday, but I think most scientists in the back of their heads know it's Nobel Prize Monday. But understanding that the chances of winning are so infinitesimally small, I went to bed at a usual hour and I just decided, you know, I'm going to try to get a good night's sleep. And then I heard the phone ring at 5 a.m. My thought was either this is the worst, most poorly timed robocall in history, or can I possibly dare believe it? I'm getting a call from Stockholm, and it turned out to be the latter. And I was greeted with the words that it's our pleasure to inform you you've won the 2019 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine.
So let's, keeping in mind that probably most Radio Boston listeners are not Nobel Prize winning scientists, in lay terms, can you explain the research for which you and two other doctors won this prize?
Oxygen, as I think most people know, is instrumental for life on Earth, certainly life on Earth as we know it. But oxygen is a very reactive and potentially toxic molecule. So too little oxygen and you're not going to survive, but too much oxygen and you're not going to survive. And so every multicellular animal on the planet, including us, has had to figure out a way to sense whether the cells and tissues in their bodies were getting enough oxygen and to respond accordingly. So to have sort of a molecular rheostat, if you will, that allows the cells and tissues to respond to changes in oxygen. And so just to give you one simple example, if you or I were to go to the top of Mount Everest, our bodies would immediately detect that we're not getting enough oxygen. In this case, it would be a global lack of oxygen. Every cell in our body would not be getting enough oxygen. And so one of the things your body would then do would be to start making more red blood cells so you could more efficiently capture what little oxygen was available.
Because the red blood cells carry the oxygen,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. But this was sort of a black box until the 90s, how this actually happens. How do cells sense whether they're getting enough oxygen and to then respond accordingly? And so the work being recognized today basically defined the molecular pathway or the molecular circuit, if you prefer, that allows cells and tissues to sense oxygen and to then respond accordingly. So I think one reason the prize is being recognized, I suspect, and again, I wish I could take credit for this, but this is really nature. Once we saw the mechanism turned out to be surprisingly simple and elegant. Especially compared to some of the more complicated models that were being put forth before we actually were able to solve the puzzle. But I think the other reason it's being recognized is because oxygen is so fundamental to, again, so many diseases as well as life on Earth more broadly. And now we have new potential therapeutics being developed based on this knowledge. For the treatment of cancers such as kidney cancers and others, like anemia and heart attack and stroke.
So now you've done this groundbreaking work, but it sounds like you had some doubts about your skills as a researcher very early in your career. Is that true?
It's absolutely true. So when I was in college, I worked in a laboratory as sort of an independent study project, hoping to round out my application to medical school. And I was given a project, which I can now say with the benefit of decades of hindsight, I was given a project that was categorically undoable, unimportant, and uninteresting, which is sort of the perfect storm for extinguishing the career of a young scientist. But I didn't know any better, and of course I blame myself, but more importantly, my professor blamed me and gave me a horrible grade, especially for pre-med, and wrote some comments on my transcript that my future didn't lie in the laboratory.
Ow.
So that was fairly punitive. And it was only when I became a fellow at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute that I had the good fortune of training with David Livingston and now being in a first-rate lab with a first-rate mentor. So for that and other reasons, I decided to take a chance and pursue a laboratory-based career.
So we're in a research-rich corridor here in New England. What kind of advice would you give to someone who's listening who wants to be you one day?
If you want to do science, first of all, jump in with both feet. Don't dabble or stick your toe in the water. The second thing I would say is I grew the fastest and have always grown the fastest when I'm surrounded by people who are smarter than me. Boston has just emerged as just this incredible ecosystem to do science. And so get to a place where you're going to be surrounded by great colleagues, hopefully great mentors, and most importantly, where you're going to be able to attract the best and brightest young people, because they're really the ones who do the work and make the magic happen.
Dr. Kalin, other than what you've been working on, what do you think is the most exciting or potentially fruitful research going on right now in your field?
So the first is so-called CRISPR-based gene editing, which is revolutionizing our way to manipulate genes with great precision. And this is changing the way we study diseases. It's changing the way we make animal models of diseases. And frankly, it's going to start to also create new classes of therapeutics. And then perhaps a little bit closer to home in the cancer field, I think the recent demonstration that you can genetically re-engineer a patient's immune cells in such a way that they will now eliminate certain cancer cells in a very specific and targeted way. So this is so-called CAR T cells. I would be surprised if that isn't eventually recognized with a Nobel Prize.
Do you think we'll ever find a cure for cancer?
I think we're making tremendous progress now, but I don't think there's going to be a one-size-fits-all treatment that's going to cure every form of cancer in every patient. I think what you're going to start to see is specific types of cancer are going to start to witness marked improvement in outcomes. I think that's where we are now. Even within a given cancer, it might be that we are able to now have more effective therapies for one flavor of breast cancer, but not another, at least in the short term.
So, Dr. Kalin, there was another Dr. Kalin, Dr.
Yes.
Carolyn Kalin,
yes.
Also a cancer researcher, and,
yes.
and your wife, until
yes.
she passed away from cancer in 2015, and I'm very
yes.
sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
How are you thinking about her and her legacy today as you process all of this?
Well, as I said, I think it's going to take a while to process. I mean, Carolyn, again, was my best friend and partner in everything I did, and I so admired her, and I wouldn't have been able to do what I did if it wasn't for the fact that, you know, she truly was my partner, as I said, in everything, including raising our two wonderful children. And frankly, we did, you know, in silly moments, imagine what would it be like if this day ever happened. And we'd even thought about where she would go to look for a new dress and, you know, who the first people we would call would be, and wouldn't this be great? So it's clearly bitter. Sweet. I mean, as I said, I think the first couple of years after she died, I was secretly hoping I wouldn't win because I just knew I would be too crushed at the thought that I couldn't share it with her. But, you know, fortunately, time helps here greatly in terms of healing such deep wounds. And now I'm at a point where I know she would be just so happy for me and would just be thrilled that I'm sharing it with my two children, as well as the many other family and friends who supported the two of us over the years and everything we tried to do.
That's Dr. William Kalin, researcher at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and the Sidney Farber Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School and a new Nobel Prize winner. Dr. Kalin, thanks again and congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Stay with us. Coming up, we'll talk with the two New York Times reporters who broke the Harvey Weinstein story, which helped launch the Me Too movement. I'm Tisiana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tisiana Deering. Over the weekend, Rowena Chu wrote for the first time about her experiences with her former boss, Harvey Weinstein. She wrote a first-person account of being sexually assaulted by the former movie producer for the New York Times. The piece comes 2 years after investigations into Weinstein's conduct against women came to light, and it feels like a new final chapter to Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters Jody Kantor and Megan Toohey's book about their experiences breaking the Weinstein story for the New York Times. The book is called She Said, Breaking the Sexual Harassment Story That Ignited a Movement. And both women join me now in Studio 3. Jody Kantor, welcome.
Thank you so much.
And Megan Toohey, wonderful to have you.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Okay, so let's jump right in. Jody, you knew Rowena Chu's story was forthcoming. You'd communicated with her during the investigation. The end of the book has this chapter. It's a big interview with lots of women who had experienced harassment from not just Weinstein. Trump had experienced employment harassment at McDonald's, et cetera. Now we're almost exactly 2 years since you guys broke the story. What is the power of hearing her now, 2 years later, and what does that mean to you as a journalist?
You know, we were so happy when Rowena decided to go on the record for our book for a couple of reasons. We wrote this book in part to bring you behind the scenes of the Weinstein investigation. The events of Me Too have come to mean so much to so many people, and we wanted to bring you to ground zero. And even though so much drama played out in the paper of the newspaper and magazines, there was so much drama that took place off the page. For instance, I first tried to speak to Rowena in the summer of 2017. She wouldn't answer my messages, so I went to her house in California, which is, you know, that's not our favorite part of reporting, is showing up at victims' homes. And she was not home, and her husband was. So I spoke to her husband, but the problem was that Rowena had never told her own husband her Weinstein story. So long story short, in that year and a half or 2 years afterwards, Rowena went through this journey of watching the impact of the Weinstein story, watching Me Too play out in public, coming onto the record for our book, and then just yesterday publishing this powerful op-ed in the New York Times. And I think what it shows is that this whole thing really has been driven about new information and new discoveries about what women have really undergone. And even 2 years after the breaking of the story, 3 months before the Weinstein trial, that process is not over.
So listeners, we want to invite you into this conversation as well. It's been 2 years since the Harvey Weinstein story broke. How were you impacted by the story, by other stories around it, by the Me Too movement? And do you have any questions for these reporters who were behind so much of it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Megan, I know Jody was the first on the story. You were on maternity leave, I think, as this all started. But this wasn't the first time people had tried to break this or similar stories. Why do you think this time it broke? Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a good question. I mean, you're right. When Jody and I, you know, really launched this investigation into Weinstein's alleged predatory behavior that stretched back decades, it was a pretty prominent rumor in Hollywood and even beyond. There were often whispers of it, sometimes even open joking about it. And there had also been reporters who had tried to get to the bottom of it. And time and again would get stuck or see their stories come to a screeching halt. And so when we were knocking on the doors and calling women, there were sometimes people who had actually participated in other stories, only to have watched them crumble. So there was a real fear on the part of our sources, and sometimes a sort of belief that nobody was ever going to be able to break this story, that Weinstein's power and influence was so vast that he would be able to succeed in basically evading scrutiny of any kind. And so, you know, we're not able to, we can't tell you exactly what happened, what went wrong, what went right in those other investigations. But what we can tell you is that the New York Times was really committed to this issue and to putting resources. Jody and I reported this story for months. We had the backing of the institution all the way up through the top. So when we were knocking on those doors, we were able to say, listen, we're coming to you with the entire support of the New York Times behind us.
So to the two of you, there were two big precursor stories. The Donald Trump Access Hollywood tapes and a number of other things. There were also the news about Bill O'Reilly. Trump went on to be president. O'Reilly did actually resign quite quickly after the stories broke about him. What did the two of you take away from those investigations as you went into your own, I'm assuming, intending from the beginning for this one to stick and for you to be able to report this one out?
Well, why don't you start with Trump and let's go in chronological order?
Well, we actually start our book. This book starts with the reporting that I did in 2016 with my colleague Michael Barbaro on the women who came forward with allegations of sexual misconduct against Trump. And that was a much different experience for both the women who came forward and also for me as a journalist. You know, not only did those allegations not result in, I mean, they certainly didn't have an impact on the outcome of the election. I also helped cover his election. But, you know, he went on the attack. He threatened to sue the New York Times. He threatened to sue the women. He called everybody a liar. And it was a really bruising experience. And so when the Weinstein investigation began, I will confess that I had that experience in the back of my head. But we had also seen our colleagues just months earlier break the Bill O'Reilly story, which was just a remarkable thing to observe. You know, Jody, do you want to explain what had happened there?
So our colleagues Emily Steele and Michael Schmidt in the spring of 2017 were able to show that for many years, Bill O'Reilly and Fox had paid a tremendous amount of money, millions and millions of dollars, to silence accusations of sexual harassment. The women were essentially paid off not to speak about their own experiences. And when they published that story, a shocking thing happened, which is that Bill O'Reilly was fired. I know now we've seen lots of powerful men fired for these kinds of allegations, but at the time, the idea that that could happen, Fox knew about the allegations. It was the public airing of those allegations in the paper that caused him to be fired. And it caused the paper to ask a kind of quaint question, which is a question that now sounds quaint to our ears, which is, are there other powerful men in American life who have abused women and covered up? And that's how we got into the Weinstein story. And also the O'Reilly story gave us a playbook because Emily and Mike were able to use those settlements as a legal and financial trail, showing that numerous women had made these kinds of accusations over the years. And that turned out to be the case with Harvey Weinstein as well. And that's part of how we were able to break the story.
So the settlements almost spoke when women wouldn't. Is that what you're saying? The paper trail of those settlements?
Right. The paper trail, these financial payoffs that had long been used to cover up allegations of misconduct. If you could illustrate that those payments had been made in the first place, time and time again, it actually helped to illuminate the alleged wrongdoing.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Rachel from Sudbury, what would you like to ask the reporters?
Hi, I would like to ask the reporters, what is happening to the women who worked for Harvey Weinstein, who were his enablers, who brought the women to the hotel rooms? In many ways, they acted as his madams. And I want to know what's happening with them, both in terms of prosecution and reputation.
Thanks for the call, Rachel.
I mean, well, Rachel, yeah, that's a good question. And in fact, you know, we were in the, when we first broke the Weinstein story 2 years ago, we had been able to connect some of the dots. But in the reporting of this book, we were able to piece together so many other pieces of the puzzle. And one of the things that we were really able to pull the curtain back on was the complicity of his own companies. And, you know, sure, there were assistants who got pulled into his patterns of alleged predation, but we were actually able to report straight up to the top of his company to, you know, Harvey Weinstein's brother and longtime business partner, Bob Weinstein, to members of the board of his companies, to like a longtime accountant who had been by Weinstein's side for 30 years. These were also individuals who got glimpses of the alleged misconduct, and actually in their own different ways tried to intervene, and especially in these 2 years, 2014 and 2015, and actually in all different ways failed to stop failed. But we really thought that it was important to, when you're looking at questions of complicity in a company, to really go straight up to the top. I mean, Bob Weinstein was Harvey's, not his, his only sibling, and they worked side by side throughout the decades that Weinstein had engaged in this alleged predation. And for the first time, he opened up to us in a series of interviews, acknowledging that he was aware of allegations of sexual misconduct going back decades. In two cases, he had actually provided the money to help silence the women, but that he chose to believe his brother when he insisted that these were all attempts at shakedowns and, you know, extramarital affairs and nothing more. And so, you know, it really raises the question. We want readers to ponder, like Rachel, we really think it's important for readers to ponder these questions, not just of the individual predator, but the other individuals who become complicit.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Alex is on the line from Medford. Alex, go ahead.
Hi, I was just wondering, I have a 2-year-old daughter, so I want to know what we can do as a general public to kind of prevent this behavior. And now that we know that this has happened and it's out in the light, what are steps we can do to teach, you know, our younger generation how to act in situations like this or how to not get into situations like this? Thank you.
Thanks for the question, Alex. Jody, do you want to answer Alex?
Sure. I mean, Alex, I think the first thing we want to say is we are right there with you. We have 3 daughters among us. 2 of them were babies or toddlers when we started this investigation. And so, like you, we felt that imperative and that responsibility to never let something like this happen again. But I think the place where we're a little different is that we're not activists and we're not legislators and we're not therapists. We're journalists. So what Megan and I feel that we can do is we can contribute to understanding this problem. You can't solve a problem you can't see. And one of the things that has turned out to be so powerful about the Weinstein story is that it's a solvent for secrecy. It's like an X-ray of how power can be misused. You have famous lawyers who crossed lines to work for Weinstein. You have people who chose to protect Harvey Weinstein instead of the women. You have these secret settlements, which are a very common legal tool and can be understandable in a lot of situations. In this case, they were used to cover up the work of an alleged predator. You have government agencies that failed. You have a human resources operation. And as Megan just pointed out, kind of an entire company that failed. So I think our role is, I think, less to, you know, offer advice or tell other people what to do, and more to say, okay, let's understand this as deeply as we can so we can have a robust conversation about what to do for the future.
Let's take another call. Abby from Harvard is on the line. Abby, go ahead. What would you like to say to the reporters?
Hi. I'd like to say I'm a 65-year-old woman, and my sisters and I were sexually abused by a very high-level cantor in the synagogue in New York. And we tried for years to get the synagogue to acknowledge that and the Cantors Association to acknowledge that. But it wasn't until the Me Too movement started, and it was definitely kicked off by these writers' work on Harvey Weinstein, that they finally called us back, and they've actually acknowledged what happened. And
you okay, you know, Abby?
I'm okay. It was just a very long, lifelong effort on our part to get this acknowledged. you know, by these synagogues and these institutions. And it's because of this work that people who are running other organizations who have the power to do something are saying, you know, I have to do it now because people are watching, people are listening. And, you know, the Me Too movement.
Let me take it from you from there, Abby. And I want to just, I'm so sorry you had that experience. And very quickly, you can reach the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255 or TALK, and the Samaritan Statewide Hotline at 1-877-870-HOPE or 870-4673. You can also reach the National Sexual Assault Hotline at 1-800-656-HOPE or 656-4673. If you're thinking about stories like Abby just called with, or if this conversation is bringing up something for you that you need help with, call those numbers, and we'll have them available for you on our website as well. Megan, Joey, how does it feel to have Abby call and say, we began to be recognized for our experiences because of your work?
Well, Abby, I mean, thank you so much for calling in. I mean, what I can tell you is that, you know, from the moment right after we published the Weinstein story, our emails and phones were flooded with calls from women and you know, even and male victims as well, sort of telling us about their experiences. Sometimes people had come forward and tried to report what had happened to them, only to run into brick walls. Other people had never gone public before and were finally felt like they were finally able to do it and finally ready to do it. And sometimes that took place in the pages of the New York Times. Sometimes that ended up taking place on social media. Sometimes that ended up taking place in terms of reporting through some of these formal channels. So I think that what Abby is describing really is twofold. I mean, it's the question of, I think it's really important that what she's talking about and is not just a single kind of alleged predator, but also an institution that it sounds like from what she's describing looked the other way. And what I can tell you is in the course of our reporting, we really think it's important to not just sort of reveal the behavior of the particular individual, but to really dive into those questions of who knew what when and these institutions that are supposed to hold people accountable, what happens when they fail.
So Jody, Megan just talked about really diving into the questions of who knew what when. In the book, the two of you acknowledge that as the movement has moved on, it's easier to accuse. With the social media world around us, you can accuse anonymously. It may be unsubstantiated. And sometimes people experience pretty extreme consequences. That opening of the aperture, is that a good thing or a bad thing as we've widened accusations and consequences as the movement has moved forward?
Well, in this book, we tell the behind-the-scenes story of the path that Christine Blasey Ford took to her powerful Senate testimony last year. And the reason we did that is we wanted to reflect that sense of mounting unfairness on both sides, both accusers and accused feeling like the system doesn't work, it isn't fair, where is this all going to end? And, what we found is that Christine Blasey Ford's story is about the most complicated Me Too story, the most complicated She Said story we've ever experienced, because we all saw that kind of powerful moment of testimony in the Senate last year. But what we did not see is the incredibly complex path it took to get there.
Okay. We are almost out of time. And I just want to ask, what are you most proud of in this work in 10 seconds?
I mean, I think that we're most proud of the incredibly courageous sources who were willing to participate in this journalism. It's not easy. I mean, there's no guarantees of what's going to happen on the other side. There were certainly no guarantees that this work would help ignite the Me Too movement. And so, I mean, we are just beyond grateful to all of our sources.
Megan Toohey and Joey Cantor are reporters for the New York Times who won the Pulitzer Prize. Thank you for being here to both of you.
Thanks again for having us.
Their new book is called She Said, Breaking the Sexual Harassment Story That Ignited a Movement. They'll be appearing in Cambridge tonight for a sold-out talk organized by the Harvard Bookstore. You can find more information at radioboston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, how one filmmaker rescued the forgotten stories of Brookline's Holocaust survivors. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. For the remainder of the program, we're going to listen to witnesses who survived the Holocaust. The stories are very powerful, and a warning, they can also be very painful to hear. In the 1990s, the town of Brookline recorded the stories of dozens of Holocaust survivors. For decades, the tapes of those interviews were locked up and forgotten in a storage closet. Now we can hear them.
I did everything possible to survive. And I walked with my head up, and I thought, now I'm going to kill these Nazi murderers. But I couldn't do it. I couldn't kill anybody. I couldn't do anything.
Filmmaker Harvey Brovman rescued more than 80 hours of those stories and made them into a documentary called Soul Witness, the Brookline Holocaust Witness Project. We spoke with Harvey about the film, and he told us about what it was like when he came across those tapes.
The first time I held the tape, it was like waves coming over me. It's almost like I knew my life was about to change. I felt like I was their last chance.
As I understand it, Harvey, there was more than 80 hours of tape. How did you know to turn it into this project?
These survivors were aching to be heard. And it took three really incredible people just to record these stories. The original Brookline Holocaust Witness Project was started by a survivor, Leon Satinstein, who at the age of 19 witnessed the liberation of Dachau. Leon met Regina Barshak, who was a survivor from France, and the two of them came up with this idea of a living memorial that instead of erecting a physical structure, it was a great listening project.
The final product, the documentary, is simple, but if you don't mind me saying, it is utterly devastating to watch. You kept it simple, I think, to keep those stories clear. Why is it so powerful to tell about the Holocaust that way?
When we first think of the Holocaust, we think of the atrocities that happened to people. But we don't think about what happens inside of a person. And I think the film tells the hidden story of what happens to the human psyche. It was very important to me that we didn't see these people as heroes, that we could see their beauty. But I think the moral of the story isn't that people survived the Holocaust. I think the moral is that beautiful people, just like those in this film, didn't survive.
The people featured in the film share really harrowing stories of tragedy, survival. One of them is Rena Chernoff, who talks about when her family spent Rosh Hashanah at Auschwitz. She says the Germans were always looking for ways to ruin Jewish holidays, and that this time they claimed there was a measles outbreak and were writing down the numbers of young boys who they would kill.
My mother came that evening to the wire fence to see my father and my brother. And my mother asked my brother, "Did they take down your number?" And my brother didn't answer at all. He just threw his piece of bread that he got to my mother over the fence, and he said, "You take it. I won't need it anymore." And he ran away.
What struck you about Rena's story?
I think what struck me about Rena's story was Rena herself, the way she could clearly articulate what happened. It was like she was watching a film from the past. And so she was sort of the journalist of the survivors.
Harvey, later in the film, one of the subjects, Rose Murrah, talks about the pain of parents who had to watch and listen to their children's screams as they were being beaten or killed. Also vice versa, children having to witness what was happening to their parents, both being able to do nothing about it. And another subject, Judith Katz, talks about how she was actually robbed of her childhood and of that innocence that should come with childhood. The subjects here were all adults when the tapes were made. They dealt, though, with trauma of a lifetime. They discussed the lasting effects physically, emotionally, mentally. How did that reality resonate with you, and how do you want it to resonate with people who see the documentary?
My goal in the film was to put the audience in the shoes of the survivor. They wanted you to know who they loved and who mattered to them, and that they're just like you and I, and so that we could try to imagine what it would be like if that had happened to us, and to learn some of the damage that happens to people that we don't think about. To me, one of the hidden crimes is what survivors did to themselves in their own mind. Survivors felt guilt for surviving.
There's a really striking moment, one of the stories. It's George Foldy, and it really struck me because it's both a moment of resilience, but also a moment of him choosing to survive when someone else didn't. He's on a death march. They're marching day and night. He talks about being so hungry that he ate his own belt, just trying to give himself something to fuel his body to keep going. And during the death march, two twin boys that he knew from high school stopped, and he talks about what happened next.
One of them couldn't walk anymore, just collapsed. And the brother went to help him up. One of the guards get over there and shoot both of them. 10, 15 minutes after that, I fall on my knees. And I got real mad. I'm not 20 years old yet. I didn't hurt anybody. I didn't do anything. I'm just too young to die. And I got up and I kept going.
Just before that, he talks about the fact that he knew that the guards had been told to shoot and kill anyone who couldn't keep walking. The determination of that, coupled with the haunting that you can see from him because he did get to keep walking and these boys he knew from high school didn't, tells so much more than just hearing the words. How do you think someone like George keeps going when so many other people didn't get to or couldn't or never had the chance?
George was military trained. His story is like Mission Impossible on steroids. Before this scene, before he was taken and put in this work camp, he was sabotaging airfields in Hungary. And he was actually later part of the Hungarian resistance against the Soviet Union. He had learned to survive, and so I think he was going by his instincts, but he also had this other kind of will that was unshakable. I've gotten to know a lot of the family members of these people. And it's really incredible to see the character, the kind of people that they raised after going through this trauma.
What do you mean by that?
It's not in the film, but I heard a survivor say that they had a good life during the day, that they had a family and children and happiness, but every night they went to bed in Auschwitz. And talking to the family members, interviewing the family members, they talk about their parents' screams in the night, the tortures that they went through. And they also talk about how loving and beautiful they were as parents. And they try to protect their children from the realities of what they experienced in the Holocaust. They wanted their children to grow up feeling hope and living a good life.
I think of one of the survivors, Esther Gens, who talks about how we should think about the roles the Germans and others had in the Holocaust.
These people really were not monsters out of space. They're ordinary people. Ordinary people were the perpetrators, and ordinary people were the victims. And ordinary people were the bystanders. And everybody had choices except for the victims.
Part of what is striking about that is the fact that people who did survive then actually had the incredible demand of having to go live an ordinary life afterward. What do we take away from that understanding?
I think it's important to note that they had to go through that the rest of their life, most of them without help. A lot of us have therapists. I have a therapist that she helped me get through the film to make it. These people didn't have anyone to listen to them, to help them navigate the rest of their lives. When the war ended, they had no country. They had no family. They had no trust. Where do you go without those three things? After World War II, people weren't listening to Holocaust survivors. Even the Jewish community wasn't. So they waited 45 years to tell their story. And when they finally did, they were told that their testimonies would be part of a living memorial. And that living memorial never came to be. So after waiting 45 years to tell their story, they had to wait another almost 30 years before the public could hear those stories.
Let's stay on that for a minute, Harvey.
Sure.
Why did no one want to let the Holocaust survivors tell their stories when they got here? Why did it take 40, 45 years before people could sit and listen or even welcome someone to tell the story?
I think it comes down to people don't want to listen to what's difficult to hear. Their family members would tell them that they don't need to talk about it, that those types of things don't happen in the United States, that that's in the past, and they don't have to worry about it. The term PTSD didn't exist then, but we all have memories of things when we were young that cause us pain now.
That are traumatic.
Right.
From what you know, what did it mean to the survivors when the Brookline Project finally gave them an opportunity to tell their stories?
I really believe that the survivors told their stories for our benefit. They went through great pain to tell these stories. They went through pain when they agreed to do it. A lot of them had to be convinced to do it. And I've come to learn they went through pain after.
At the end of the film, Arthur Friedman, the nephew of one of the survivors, Leon Sattenstein, talked about what it was like for Jews who had survived the Holocaust to reckon with what they'd been through.
They tried to talk to people that they met, to in the synagogue, to the rabbis, to others, to family members that they had. Nobody wanted to listen to them. They were trembling with the remembrances of their experiences.
The Holocaust is a specific and unique trauma for people. One of the lessons it seems like Arthur Friedman is talking about there, however, is that people have trauma in their lives and they try to ask for help from their communities. And communities have a choice to make about whether to listen and respond and support or not. You've said these survivors didn't have people providing that support. Synagogues are going to watch this documentary. People from religious parishes are going to watch this documentary. Community members are going to watch this documentary. What commitment do you want them to make when they come out afterward?
We all have images from after the war, the bombed out cities, the gruesome scenes from concentration camps. We can fix our cities. We can rebuild them. We can mourn our dead. But how do you help mend and heal the wreckage that goes inside of a human's mind and their heart if they've survived something like this? I hope from the film people have a higher level of vigilance about staying present in the face of all kinds of unjustifiable hate and intolerance.
You have said that these tapes changed your life. How?
I think the people in the tapes changed my life. They gave me strength to complete the film. I had never made a feature-length film. I knew a lot about the Holocaust, but I wasn't a scholar. And I had 9 months to produce the work in progress version that was first seen at the Coolidge. I spent 12 to 14 hours a day, 7 days a week in the first stage of this project, just living inside of the testimonies. I only had a limited budget. I had put my business on hold so that I could make the film. And I doubted myself. I'm not Ken Burns. And the survivors got me through it. That was the hardest part, was living in the testimonies, because I had to go about doing the regular things too, right? I was walking around this earth with too much perspective.
Ordinary life.
At the time that I felt the most doubt about myself, I was watching the testimony of Alan Shaw, and the film ends with his words. And I was feeling sorry for myself. Imagine you're listening to Holocaust testimonies and you're feeling sorry about yourself. But we all get self-obsessed. And after listening to him, and I just realized I needed to grow up and make the film and just do it. This was my calling. This was what I was meant to be doing.
One of the single most intimate gifts someone can share with someone else is their story. There is an incredible amount of giving by sharing these stories that comes through in this documentary. What should the long-term legacy of that sharing be?
I hope it opens the doors for us to listen to other survivors from other atrocities, but maybe also our family members. I'm guessing that people who survive rape, that one of their biggest issues is no one will listen to them tell about that unspeakable experience they went through. And maybe it'll help us listen to each other. There's nothing we could do about the Holocaust. It's past. It ended before most of us were born. But we can do something about how we treat each other, I think.
That's Harvey Bravman talking about his film Soul Witness, the Brookline Holocaust Witness Project. Harvey, thank you so much for joining us. There will be a free screening of Soul Witness tonight at the Psy Performance Center at Boston University. You can find out more information on our website, radioboston.org. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.